Well, good afternoon. My name is Stephen Hopkins from the Department of Religion here at Swarthmore College. It's my great pleasure to have the opportunity to introduce a dear colleague, Professor Tariq Al-Jamil, for this faculty sabbatical leave lecture. It's very interesting, these opportunities. Now, I see a lot of students here, which is quite good, and I see faculty members as well. These kinds of lectures give us an opportunity to have a sense of the other side of our vocation here at Swarthmore College. We often talk about teacher scholars. And I know for myself, and I know that after many of our lunch discussions on long-range planning, I know many of us feel the need to know more about the scholarship of our colleagues, to have the opportunity to give ear to not only discussions about our classroom, and again, you students, and et cetera, and education at Swarthmore, but our private lives as scholars and productive scholars. These are our twin ideals here at Swarthmore. So it's again a pleasure for me to be here. Tariq came to Swarthmore, to the Department of Religion in the fall of 2006 from the Department of Philosophy of Religion at North Carolina State University. He received his BA with honors in religion at Oberlin College in 1995, an MTS at Harvard Divinity School in 97, received his PhD at Princeton University in Islamic Studies and the program in Near Eastern Studies in 2004, completing a dissertation on Shi'i and Sunni relations in medieval Baghdad. And I know for a fact that he is one of the favorite first students of Sean Marmon, and still be perhaps her favorite. You know, the first is always the most important one. A distinguished scholar of Islam at Princeton. Tariq has speaking and reading knowledge of classical, medieval, and modern Arabic, with reading and basic conversational skills also in Persian and Urdu. I say this because he has brought considerable language skills to his teaching here at the college. He's not only helped to establish and to undergird and develop Islamic studies and the Arabic programs, but has advised original student theses in Arabic, and again, something that we longed for in our department, feeling language is quite important to understanding things, is to have someone who can do that, who can read quite remarkably complex religious texts with students who are interested in doing such things and spend inordinate hours in his office doing so. That's the teacher part of the scholar. Student interest in Tariq's classes was instantaneous, and judging by the long lines in the hallway that still develop, he's still doing very well, and it's not abated. His courses range widely from our senior seminars in the study of religion, and again, Tariq has a grasp of the field as a whole, along with his focus in Islam, gender, sexuality in the body, and Islamic discourses, the Quran and its interpreters, to seminars and courses on Islamic law and history. And next spring, he'll be teaching a course that's related in a comparative way to the talk this afternoon on secrecy. Tariq has been the recipient of the George E. Becker Faculty Fellowship, Swarthmore College, 2009 and 10, as well as a Lindbeck Foundation Minority Faculty Research Fellowship for research in Damascus, Syria. His book manuscript, Power and Knowledge in Medieval Baghdad, 1258-1386, notice the historical context, is currently under review. Recent articles by Tariq include Shi'i Hadith Methodology and Shi'i Legal Argumentation, Ibn Taymiyyah and Shi'i Polemics, The Struggle for Religious Authority in Medieval Islam, Identity and Power, Sunni and Shi'i Discursive Competition in Medieval Biographical Literature. Tariq's current research focuses on Shi'ism and intercommunal violence, religious dissimulation, and the transmission of knowledge in medieval Islam, also gender and sexuality in Islam. And his next book, which should be a bestseller, I would imagine, is on the relationship between marriage, divorce, and slavery in Islamic law. Tariq brings to all his work not only an ear to critical social theory, but for some strange reason has an undying obsession with psychoanalytic theory. Talk about that. Anyway, his lecture this afternoon, I share this irrational passion for psychoanalytic theory. Anyhow, the focus of his lecture this afternoon will bring new methodological approaches to bear on a very well-known theme in Twelver Shi'ism, taqiyya, or religious dissimulation. The focus of his lecture is to explore not only the theoretical, theological, and legal dimensions, but more precisely bodily practices and social behaviors associated with the performance of taqiyya in 13th and 14th century Iraq, It's my great pleasure to introduce my colleague, Tariq Al-Jamil.
Thank you so much for coming out on Thursday, and thank you so much, Stephen, for such a generous introduction. I do appreciate that. I am humbled by such an introduction. I would like to, I think it's perhaps appropriate to just start right in and to say something about what is this business about taqiyya. Taqiyya is an accepted principle in both Shi'i and Sunni forms of Islam, and it tends to be based on a number of Quranic verses, including the verse that you see here, which is not necessarily explicit to some of the later social practices that we will see associated with it, but it is as follows, that the faithful should not take the faithless for allies instead of the faithful. And whoever does that, Allah will have nothing to do with him unless it is done as a precaution in order to guard yourselves from them. But perhaps the verse receiving the most attention in discussions of taqiyya has been this one. That is, whoever expresses disbelief in God after once believing will suffer greatly unless that person is under compulsion while his heart is at rest in prayer. So that this particular verse is believed to have in most commentaries about it, is taken to refer to a companion of the Prophet Muhammad, Ammar bin Yasir, who is outwardly at the time of its revelation, was outwardly denying Muhammad's prophecy and worshiping pagan idols in order to protect himself while he was in Mecca. But the verse has been interpreted more broadly to mean that a Muslim or Muslima may deny her faith or violate Islamic law if her life is threatened. So from this very basic conception of taqiyya, the Shi'is have in fact employed much more expansive uses of the concept and application. So the practice of dissimulation itself is often characterized in Shi'i literature as including the ability to employ secrecy or kitman. And this secrecy is viewed as being able to be employed for the benefit of the individual or group. However, the use of secrecy has led many scholars to skeptically view secrecy and concealment merely as a tactic for ensuring survival in the context of social marginalization and political persecution. This has in turn produced a number of assumptions concerning the practice of secrecy and its relationship to suspicion. Mainly the idea that what one wishes to conceal is inherently negative or even pernicious. The idea that secrecy can corrupt and debilitate character is perhaps one of the first ways in which taqiyya was understood by scholars writing on Islam. For instance, at the early part of the 20th century, Golzier, a very well-established Orientalist, says that taqiyya resulted in what he called a suppressed fury among the Shia, which in turn, quote, led to unrestrained hatred and fanaticism. Now, however, unlike Golzier, I've seen in the literature the use of taqiyya that actually refers to a set of practices that are neither laudable or loathable, but rather function as unifying features for defining group, solidarity, and belonging. So not only does control over secrecy preserve central aspects of identity, it guards their changes, its growth, and decay. So that the dual conundrum of power requires not only knowledge, but the capacity to put knowledge to use. But without the knowledge, there is no chance to exercise power. So that to have no insight into what others conceal is to lack power as well. The secret, then, is a discursive strategy,
a strategy that transforms knowledge into a scarce resource and serves then
as a valuable commodity, the possession of which bestows prestige
or symbolic capital on its owner. So discussions of Taqiyya
primarily in the contemporary period have concentrated mainly on theoretical discussions involving hadith and legal literature. So with few exceptions, most of the discussions that have preceded mine have focused primarily on theoretical considerations, with the exception, I suppose, of the work of Devin Stewart, who produced a relatively short article, on the travels of a scholar, Bahauddin al-Amali, during the Ottoman Empire, roughly between around the 10th century. That is the 10th century Hijri or the 16th century of the Common Era. I often have problems with these dates. But so generally, when I mention a date, I'm talking about the Islamic dates. So
there have been very few, if any, attempts other than Devin Stewart's study to think about Taqiyya as practice
or the constitutive elements of its performance. So what is it? Is Taqiyya the sociological phenomena of passing,
for instance?
Most people would be familiar with this idea of passing. Is it passing or not? Actually, in my work, I've found that there's enough divergence,
or at least enough divergence to cast doubt on the congruities between the modern notion of passing
and the medieval practice of dissimulation, in particular because of the differences between the kind of bodily practices associated with Taqiyya and also the kind of racialized context and the racial implications of passing. So the short answer to that is I don't believe that Taqiyya easily maps on to what sociologists have defined as passing, but I'll say more about that later. So that the relationship between the practice of Taqiyya and Shia living in predominantly Sunni areas and the multivalent forms of power and strategies for their cultivation during the pre-modern period are, in my opinion, unique. So that dissimulation functioned not only as a means to subvert and undermine the marginalization of Shia
in areas where they constituted the minority group, but it also simultaneously functioned as a powerful tool for the creation
of more egalitarian possibilities for the preservation of forms of privileged knowledge. Now, this privileged knowledge obviously was internally shared, but externally undisclosed, and generated further forms of religious connections.
So what did pre-modern scholars mean when they talked about the distinction between our sect, you commonly see the phrase ta'ifatuna,
our group, and the other? What did these kinds of associations imply? What were the boundaries for exclusion from the group? Were they bodily? And if they were bodily, then we have to consider some of the communal aspects of the body and its role for complicating the actual performance of taqiyya in social context. So what is it? What do you have to do to actually dissimulate? Do you have to pray differently? Do you have to wash for prayer differently? Do you have to have certain ideas about what constitutes Islam? Is it based on forms of devotion? Is it, in fact, doctrinal? So, in essence, the sustained performance of taqiyya might include a multitude of actions and behavior that cannot directly be associated with expressions of religion or belief.
So, how do we begin to answer
the important questions about taqiyya, given that we're relying upon medieval sources that are primarily literary? So that one of the most important and perhaps immediate questions that one can ask about dissimulation is what is meant to be safeguarded? So is there something particular to an individual, or is it a set of broader community interests, or a combination of both these things? Can taqiyya be limited to the protection of a specific doctrine? Or can it, in fact, be used to keep secrets from people who are internal to the group as well as external to the group?
For instance,
in the Druze religion, adherents tend to be divided into two categories, people who are jahal, or ignorant people, or the uqal, the so-called knowledgeable ones, the sages. And only the latter category are allowed to read the sacred texts of the religion or to attend the khalwa, or the secret ceremony of worship. So this is one way of thinking about the use of dissimulation, that is, creating a distinction between those who are knowledgeable and then the larger group, the everyday people, the awam, who essentially are ignorant of the religion's basic precepts. So the key to really thinking about all of these questions about dissimulation, for me, is thinking about the use and application of strategies for dissimulating in specific social contexts. Okay, so that this really isn't a theoretical discussion. So in that light, I'd like to give you some preliminary information on really what this issue speaks to, because I don't think it's easy to understand the implications of dissimulation without understanding certain pre-modern ways, that is, early modern understandings of the academic study of Islam. So, and I'm reminded here, I think, of just recently, even in a congressional poll, some 43% of members of Congress could not name one distinction between Sunni and Shi'i. So I will assume that we are a much more educated audience than that, but nonetheless, I will say a little bit about this basic distinction. So, the coexistence of the Shi'i and Sunni communities are perhaps the oldest and most enduring historical, political, and theological distinction in Islamic civilization. The origins of the Shi'i community itself has been the subject of ongoing disagreement between Western scholars and traditional Shi'i chroniclers and hagiographers. The early manifestations of Shi'ism tended to revolve around a sense of walaya. It's a very difficult term to understand because it has such broad import, in particularly in the early Islamic centuries. But it means something like devotion, something like loyalty, and is probably the earliest sense that we have of a kind of proto-Shi'i community. And if we think about his absolute attachment or support for the Prophet's cousin and son-in-law Ali, and that he would succeed the Prophet as legitimate ruler and interpreter of religion for the community. So then Shi'i doctrine projects the existence of this form of Shi'ism back to the Prophet's demise or even before that time. So there's growing academic support actually for this view among scholars in universities in the United States and Europe, for instance. And relatively recent works by scholars like Wilfred Madelin, Patricia Crona, and Martin Hines have found support for traditional Shi'i accounts in the historical record. In any case, there's general agreement that Shi'ism existed as a coherent and distinct point of view with a recognizable identity from the first Islamic century.
Less than 30 years after the death of the Prophet Muhammad, the first civil war ultimately culminated with the murder of Ali, and it was clear that by this time, the Shi'at Ali, or Ali's party, or supporters, represented a distinct community that expressed not only its political and military aspirations, but also involved claims to religious authority. So that here, Islamists have tended to ignore this early religious dimension and reduce the conflict to issues revolving around the nature of successorship to Muhammad or personal allegiance to Ali and his descendants. However, scholars have also anachronistically represented Sunnism as merely a kind of normative Islam, established in a unified position, so that it was a kind of orthodoxy against which alternative positions struggled for legitimacy. And this is, I think, probably one of the most common tropes that one finds in sort of introductory texts about the distinction between Sunnism and Shi'ism, that somehow there was a normative Islam that fell from the sky and it was doctrinally organized around the principles of what constituted later Shi'ism, Sunnism. This is simply not the case. So that, one,
Muslims, Shi'i Muslims in particular, do not define themselves oppositionally. Rather, the Shia have always considered themselves to be an integral part of the fabric of the Islamic religious community, and in fact claim to represent the most elite group of faithful within the community. So to dismiss Shi'ism as merely as a dangerous heterodoxy that deviated from the mainstream of Islamic thought and practice is to misunderstand the nature of the development of early Islamic society. So Sunnism, or the later as it was called, the Ahl Sunnah wa Jama'ah, the people of custom and community, they did not exist as a doctrinal perspective until the late 2nd century. Moreover, one of the founding principles of Sunni belief is the inherent justice, wisdom, and legitimacy of the first four Khulafa, or Khulafa al-Rashidun, the rightly guided caliphs, and that is Abu Bakr, Omar, Uthman, and Ali. So rather than represent a majority consensus from which the Shia deviated in recognizing only the legitimacy of Ali, the very articulation of this foundational principle of Sunnism was a compromise between the earlier non-Shi'i recognition of only the first three Khulafa as encompassing the ideas of Islamic leadership on one hand, and the Shi'i insistence upon Ali's supremacy. So that what I'm suggesting here is that perhaps we can think about Sunnism as a kind of oppositional movement that was designed itself to respond to the existence of forms, specific patterns of devotion to individuals. So Sunnism, rather than be normative Islam, was a response to the kind of diversity present in the community. So when we, on one hand, we think about it from this perspective, but also this perspective on the origins of Sunnism came to be dominant in Western scholarship on Islam, primarily because the Western scholars who first approached this material simply took the normative perspective of Sunnism for granted. Why did they do that? Because they primarily read Sunni chronicles, Sunni biographical dictionaries, and Sunni materials that were theologically invested in the idea of perpetuating a kind of normative Sunnism. So it's perhaps forgivable in some ways that the first Western scholars to approach this material simply adopted the perspective of their medieval sources. Of course, this creates a difficult perspective for Shi'ism, which in fact, again, writing in the late 19th century, Golzier in fact says that Shi'ism is a sect in the Islamic context, and that any group that departs from the Sunnah, or historically sanctioned form of Islam, on essential issues, of fundamental issues of importance, contradicts Sunni ijma. And what he means by this is that he simply accepted Sunni polemical sources and heresiological literature for inquiry into the religious worldview of Shi'ism. So that, in fact, these hostile sources may lead one to overestimate the importance of even the kind of extremist elements in the Shi'i community. So that fringe Shia, who were groups who were often far left of central Shi'i perspective, were proofs for Golzier of what he referred to Shi'ism as a particularly fecund soil for absurdities suited to undermine and wholly disintegrate the Islamic doctrine of God. I think that perhaps it makes more sense to think about these two divisions in the Islamic community as two branches or streams of thought in Islam, of course of varying size, both of which can be regarded as authentic expressions of Islamic piety. These streams should not be envisioned as proceeding in paths of clear divergence from one another. Rather, they converge at many points intellectually, politically, and historically. It becomes clear when one looks at the sources in detail that analysis of heresiographical and polemical literature from both sides, that it's not a matter of two streams progressively dividing and subdividing into numerous rivulets of thought, but rather the Sunni-Shi'i dichotomy is more accurately compared to a series of small tributaries which eventually coalesce into two large streams that we recognize today as Sunnism and Shi'ism. Okay, it's a very wordy water metaphor to explain, I think, a very basic process, which is that these groups developed largely in opposition to one another, and that there was a dialogic process by which these communities were formed, rather than a kind of assumption of a consolidated Islam that was somehow descended from the sky. So what does this all have to do with taqiyya? For one, there are very few studies that focus on Sunni-Shi'i relations begin with the formative period in the development of the Islamic community. More specifically, over struggles for leadership immediately following the death of Muhammad. So that the skewed emphasis on the historical origins has led scholars to almost entirely ignore subsequent developments and relations between the two communities. So my research on the performance of taqiyya, or dissimulation, seeks to contribute to the body of knowledge concerning Islam by highlighting the ways in which these two streams of Islamic community converge in concrete historical circumstances and geographical locations far beyond the formative period of Islamic civilization. Contrary to the narratives articulated by scholars who attempted to generalize about the nature of Sunni-Shi'i relations for all times and all places, when viewed in concrete social and political circumstances, there's a great deal of messiness and murkiness in the expression of forms of group solidarity and belonging. And the developments in jurisprudence, theology, and philosophy tend to have significant overlap. So that the social historical approaches better illustrate the degree of diversity and tolerance tolerated, the degree of difference tolerated in pre-modern Islam by both Sunni and Shi'is if they continue to engage in the self-conscious process of defining nature, that is the nature of group membership and belonging. So a particularly highly fascinating and instructive way of thinking about these differences is looking at taqiyya, that is, the social uses of taqiyya. Okay? So how, in fact, does this process of dissimulating step into identity formation during historical times beyond the early period? My work actually centers on Baghdad as a city, for looking at dialogue between Sunni and Shi'i scholars. And it makes sense, I think, to ask, why Baghdad? So that during the 7th and 8th centuries in particular, Baghdad, which had been a long-established center of learning in the Muslim world, began to establish itself as a site of mutual participation, where Sunni and Shi'i scholars gathered together as both students and teachers. And more importantly, the participation in shared learning was not an exception to the general pattern of learning that took place during this time. If we bring to bear on this context modes of historical analysis and close looks at Arabic literature, including biographical dictionaries, chronicles, endowment deeds, texts on law and theory, polemical treatise, genealogical works, we clearly see a much more nuanced picture. And I do this in the context of Baghdad for a number of reasons. One, Baghdad was an important commercial and political center, so it was the home of the Abbasid Caliph. It had a number of very important religious institutions where considerable endowments were available for religious training, and that we see fairly exemplary patterns of scholarship taking place between the two groups in the city. There was also a particular policy of keeping the Shi'i imams under a form of de facto house arrest in Iraq, in particular in Baghdad, and this led to an increased Shi'i presence there. Also, it was a major place for shrine visitation, and the major Shi'i shrines were located just to the south of Baghdad in Najaf and Karbala and Kufa as well. And Last but not least, there was a thriving Shi'i merchant community in a outlying suburb of the city. So that Baghdad is an interesting place for thinking about the performance of taqiyya in local context. So we also have the scholars who are actually engaged in these scholarly networks producing texts about what they're doing simultaneously, so that we have texts from this period where scholars are self-consciously writing about themselves. And these works have been perhaps the most significant in the formation of Shi'i studies over time. Now, one of the things that one has to think about in looking at taqiyya is this kind of popular notion that somehow there was a Sunni revival in the 5th or 11th century. And what this means is that by this time there was a consolidation of Sunnism such that personal connections between scholars was precluded by the fact that one had to declare allegiance to a particular school. Okay, so that is, one had to declare whether one was Sunni or Shi'i to actually study in institutions of religious learning. Now, one of the problems with that is that these things seem to only apply to cases where scholars were resident students. So where scholars were not resident, people were free to approach the transmission of knowledge together in a way that did not seem to challenge Sunni or Shi'i identity. Now, when one thinks about how this functioned on a practical level, we see that there was this notion of consensus, ijma, which was a strategy for, in many ways, confronting the idealized or normative position, the proposed normative position of Sunnism. So that when we see that there were forms of symbiotic dialogue and social interactions between Sunni and Shi'i scholars, taqiyya functioned to undermine the very notion of a kind of Sunni consensus. So that we see on a practical level that by this time, that is the 5th and 11th century, Sunni jurists themselves often disagreed concerning points of law and theology, and many were subjugated to charges of violating consensus and subverting established doctrinal positions. So that the efforts of the Sunni majority to limit the influence, for instance, of their own scholars, like, for instance, Ibn Taymiyyah, who was considered by many modern revisionist historians to be the model of medieval Sunni traditionalism, attest to this fact. So the notion of ijma, or consensus, was developed as a legal doctrine designed to limit the indeterminacy inherent in the Islamic concept of political authority. The doctrine of ijma plainly stated that at a certain point, established Islamic doctrinal formulations and methodological perspectives were permitted and were no longer permitted to be debated, and were established and were considered to be permanently resolved. The doctrine of consensus proved to be extremely problematic. Although the majority of Shi'i scholars of Islamic jurisprudence, Sunni scholars of Islamic jurisprudence, accepted the notion of consensus, they disagreed on, for instance, whose consensus counted. They disagreed on whether that was the companions of the Prophet, the jurists, or the general community. They also disagreed on whether the consensus of all jurists should be counted, so whether it was the jurists of a specific geographical location, or whether it was jurists who maintained specific qualifications or prerequisites. They also disagreed on how consensus could be verified, for instance, whether the silence of a jurist on a particular issue could count towards consensus. In addition, they disagreed on whether the consensus of one generation binds subsequent generations, or whether consensus established in one region binds another. More importantly, the majority of jurists recognized that refusing or denying the existence of a consensus did not establish one as an unbeliever. The contested issue surrounding the doctrine of consensus ultimately meant that ijma, largely functioned as a rhetorical device in the polemics among various schools, most prominently in debates between Shi'i and Sunni scholars. However, the overemphasis on consensus obscures the degree of diversity present and tolerated among medieval jurists themselves and ignores fields of religious learning in which Shi'i and Sunni scholars study together in relative cooperation.
So one recent study argues that beginning in the late 3rd century,
Shi'i scholars throughout the Islamic world utilized taqiyya, or dissimulation, in order to participate in Sunni education. However, this work doesn't provide reference to suggest that affiliation with one particular legal school, in this case the Shafi'i school, would have constituted the performance of taqiyya in the context. In particular, in the context of a specific medieval place or region. So how do we in fact know that this was taqiyya, that to actually attend or accept a particular Sunni school of thought, or as it was later identified, encompass the practice of taqiyya? According to my own examination of over 2,000 Shi'i biographical entries written during the 7th and 8th centuries, Shi'i scholars themselves did not yet refer to themselves as belonging to a distinct legal school, as it was conceived in the Sunni scholarly milieu. Contemporary Shi'i and Sunni sources refer to Shi'i scholars as belonging to the, quote, Shi'i madhab, rather than the kind of technical term that we see in later tradition of referring it to it as Ja'fari. So the term Ja'fari was not used to refer to a specific school, nor is it affixed to the name of Shi'i scholars as a part of their name or as their nisba in their biographies. So that this may suggest that distinctive Shi'i legal identity was still in its formative stages, and Shi'ism was, and that undertaking study in a particular Sunni school did not, in fact, compromise any sense of Shi'i group belonging or identity. So that this kind of focus on Shi'i responses to the development of Sunni ijma, in fact, minimizes the complex relationships of power between Sunni and Shi'i scholars in the pre-modern period. In fact, we see the development of a number of very important scholarly disciplines taking place among both groups roughly simultaneous, so that a scholar like Najm ad-Din Ja'far al-Hassan al-Hilli introduced concepts into Shi'i jurisprudence of taqlid and ijtihad that he borrowed and elaborated from Sunni works. Jamal ad-Din ibn Tawus and ibn Muntahir al-Hilli at the same period introduced concepts that borrowed and rejected that were in dialogue with Sunni concepts of hadith criticism. Scholars like Shams ad-Din Muhammad, Abdullah ad-Jinzi al-Amali introduced a kind of distinctive way of thinking about Shi'i jurisprudence that had not been articulated. So how do we actually figure out, given the complexities of determining identity, where identity is not fully formed and you have this kind of taqiyya in the distance, this concept of the ability to dissimulate? One, I think if one looks at a variety of Arabic documents, a more nuanced picture emerges. In particular, if one looks at teaching permission slips, which I had perhaps the pleasure or displeasure of looking at thousands of these rather pedantic documents that simply describe with whom a particular scholar has studied. Also, if you look at the dedications of books from the period and whether or not they dedicated to a Sunni or Shi'i scholar, a Sunni or Shi'i ruler, complicates the picture. But probably more than any other source, the complications of representing identity in biographical dictionaries. So taqiyya functions in literary sources as a strategy of competition between Sunni and Shi'i scholars. And you can see it clearly in the literary sources. In particular, when thinking about biographical dictionaries, one of the first problems that one encounters is that taqiyya functions as an allegation. So that there is this phenomena of claiming as a broader strategy for I think, engaging in trying to mediate the asymmetries of power between the two groups. So that there's this complication in rendering, such as Ibn Taymiyyah characterizes one of his colleagues as, quote, one of those where a Shi'i acts like a Sunni and a Sunni acts like a Shi'i. What does that mean? What does that suggest about identity and group membership in this context? And one of the things that I hedge on in my own work about this is thinking about identity. I have this sort of very visceral reaction to the idea of pre-modern identity because it's not a term that my medieval subjects used, and they were clearly ambivalent about the idea of what it meant to have a kind of static idea of what one was outside of context. So I'll say more about that later, but there's this process in biographical dictionaries of claiming. So that what we see is a particular scholar being represented as Sunni in one context, represented as Shi'i in the Shi'i context. How do we know? How do we know who these people are? Let me actually just skip to an example of this, and I'll come back to some of the more specific things about taqiyya. If I could get my screen to work. Ah! Voila! It works. Okay. So here's an example of entry in a biographical dictionary. Ali ibn Abdul Karim ibn Ahmed ibn Musa ibn Jafar ibn Muhammad ibn Muhammad ibn Ahmed ibn... Oh, okay. Well, his has a long name. So it goes, it begins. Ibn Rajib mentioned in his Mu'ajjim that Sayyid al-Naqib used to sit preaching in the shrine of Musa al-Qazim, composing and reciting good poetry. He used to curse the Rawafid, which is a kind of pejorative term that was used during the time for Shi'is. It means kind of, I guess, like turncoat or, I can't, it's a pejorative term. And he was cleared of suspicion of being one of them. He used to visit the tomb of Imam Ahmed, and this is in Baghdad, and he persisted in his adherence to Sunnism, in particular when he saw the Rawafid drowning throughout Iraq, and it, i.e. the flood, did not come near the tomb of Imam Ahmed, the founder of one of the popular Sunni schools, one of the surviving Sunni schools. Ali ibn Abdul Karim took the Shia in ships and showed them this miracle. This account is recorded many times by Kamal ibn al-Fuwati and other scholars. He died during the year 749 in Baghdad and was buried in the Qazmi shrine. There's a lot going on here. So on one hand, the author has the problem of the name. Okay, so that his name clearly associates him with a kind of Shi'i genealogy. So that hence the long genealogy of Husayni, al-Baghdadi, but he attaches al-Hanbali to the end of the name to imply that he had some kind of affiliation with a Sunni legal school, and hence places him at the shrine of Ahmed ibn Hanbal, cursing the Shia. And this is a very important dimension, because in thinking about how to distinguish people, cursing is one of the primary methods used to distinguish religious identity. If you curse the opposition, you're assumed to be one of the others. And there's, of course, this miraculous quality, so he demonstrates this to the Shia, but it just demonstrates the kind of very contested nature of thinking about how these things work. So then, what do we know from a narrative like this about what constituted taqiyya? We know that there are certain behaviors that are associated with the performance of taqiyya. For one, there is a changing of the place of prayer and the performance of ritual obligations, so that one goes to a popular site, whether it be a Shi'i or a Sunni site. There's a modification of one's name or genealogy, one's nisba or nisab. And there's a connection to prominent Sunnis. Okay, so as you see, all of these things happening here in this biography. And there's typically a change, though you don't see it here, in external appearance. So either one wears a ring, one wears a beard in a particular style, one adjusts one's style of clothing, or, as I mentioned earlier, the production of documents or specific kinds of monographs. Now, when we think about taqiyya in terms of its social functions, one of the hadith traditions related to it says, beware of consequences of slip-ups. And this occurs in a section on taqiyya in probably the most authoritative Shi'i hadith work. And what this implies is that its inclusion in that particular section is not just a moral imperative to consider the consequences of one's actions, but it also implies that taqiyya is not a single statement or action during a time of duress, but it's a careful, sustained performance that may involve many disparate acts, interrelated acts from a complex narrative that makes up an individual social self. So that taqiyya is a complicated set of behaviors, not simply the performance of one act or one statement. Let me go back to taqiyya in religious sources. So that there are many traditions, hadith-based traditions associated with taqiyya. So you see hadith in this particular section on the chapter on taqiyya, that the divine mystery is a secret veiled in a secret. God likes to be worshipped in secret. In taqiyya lies 9/10 of religion. He who has no taqiyya has no faith. Taqiyya is part of God's religion. Taqiyya is to be used in every necessity. Taqiyya is applied to everything which man is compelled. Taqiyya is part of religion, my religion and the religion of my ancestors. So that the Shi'i imams are often depicted is emphasizing the taqiyya is a very important sacred duty. So Ja'far as-Sadiq, the sixth Shi'i imam, says, what pleases me more than taqiyya? By God, nothing on the face of the earth is more pleasing to me than taqiyya. It is not permitted to lift one's taqiyya until such time as he who shall arise, that is, the occultated 12th Shi'i imam, returns. He who does so places himself outside of God's religion and the religion of the imamis. So that taqiyya is considered to be one of the very important dimensions, one of the very important doctrines of Shi'ism. Now, what does this mean in terms of social practice? There is this case of trying to identify what constitutes being Shi'i as opposed to having Shi'i proclivities. So, for instance, we see often in biographical dictionaries the use of the phrase at-tashayyuh bila raft, which means kind of mild Shi'ism. A kind of Shi'ism without being, you're a Shi'i, but you're not a complete turncoat. So that there are degrees in how this occurs in the form of performance. There's also the problem of the distinction between legal and doctrinal meanings of taqiyya. So that, for instance, again, Ibn Taymiyyah, prominent Sunni scholar from the period, engages in an anti-Shi'i polemical diatribe where he reduces taqiyya to simply lying and hypocrisy. He says, quote, "For what is hypocrisy other than a man to speak what he does not hold in his heart?" So that the presence of Sunni polemical accusations of taqiyya and the gradual increase in Shi'i apologetics concerning its social practice and meaning throughout the medieval period necessitates great historiographic due diligence for approaching its use and application in local contexts. So that over time, it's a kind of accusation that's flung by both sides to discredit one another. So here's another example of an entry from a biographical dictionary describing a scholar, and I won't reveal whether he's Shi'i or Sunni till the end, but he says, he was a highly respected, powerful, highly knowledgeable and widely known Sayyid, that is, descendant of the Prophet Muhammad. He was Wali and Niqiba. He was the of the cemetery, which is a technical title for his position within the regime of the time. Ibn Inba mentioned in his Umda the passing of his grandfather as Sayyid Jamal ad-Din Ahmed. I saw that he, that is Ali ibn Abdul Karim, reported a flood in Baghdad in the year 725, and he was Naqib. He died in the violent plague in the year 749 and was buried in the Qazmi Shrine. So he's referring to this incident, but in this case, he brings in the subject's grandfather from the previous narrative to suggest that he too could have been Sunni, in spite of the obvious Shi'i name and genealogy. You have other examples of this, where a biographical dictionary mentions that the two of them, Ali ibn Abdul Karim and his cousin, were given the honorific title, the same honorific title and the same philonymic during their lifetime. This form of naming was strange to the Persians, but among the Arabs it was quite common. In particular, in earlier times. In general, I saw attributed to him a text, and so he names his books. And then, of course, he brings in the genealogy to establish him as a potentially as a Sunni scholar. So, when one looks at biographical dictionaries and chronicles, they provide an interesting starting point for the examination of the uses, the social uses of taqiyya. Careful examination of literary sources shed lights on the self-descriptions of the ulama and highlights the complexities, ambiguities, and potential dangers of Sunni-Shi'i interaction in the context of competition for authority and legitimacy. In addition, viewing the form, content, and production of biographical accounts as themselves mechanisms for articulating competing claims for social and academic prestige is instructive for approaching the question of group membership and religious affiliation. So that when we look at, again, an account like this, we see that the content of this biographical description suggests a great deal about the contested nature of identity and religious authority. So one of the principal problems is the nisba, or the name, the scholar's name, Al-Husayni. It indicates that he is, as I said earlier, a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad's immediate family, and it is a particularly kind of privileged genealogical status, so that from the earliest of times, Shi'i and Sunni sources assigned an elevated position to the genealogy of the two grandsons of the Prophet, Hassan and Hussein, and it's largely derived from a number of hadith that celebrate the people from this particular lineage. So what he does is tries to draw from this lineage to actually claim him within the Shi'i, the Sunni school, for increased prestige. So if there are these asymmetries of power so that Shi'is have to dissimulate, why is it that in biographical sources, these sources are keen to claim Shi'is for their own prestige and the cultivation thereof? I could say more about that, but I won't. I want to open it up to some questions, so I will actually cut myself short and offer up a few final thoughts about this issue. So that in the talk, I specifically focus on Shi'i and Sunni scholars in Baghdad from the Mongol conquest of Iran in Iraq to the execution of the Abbasid Caliph. However, I think this dynamic of scholarly travel across Muslim lands during the period has potentially wider implications for my study. However, one must ask whether or not the relationship between Shi'i and Sunni scholars in Baghdad was also the case in other medieval cities in the Islamic world. However, I think there's sufficient evidence to suggest that scholars duplicated this pattern elsewhere, my methodology takes as its starting point that relationships between Sunni and Shi'i scholars in Baghdad may have different meanings, functions, and goals than similar relationships in other cities in the Islamic world. Rather than create a kind of universal template by which Shi'i and Sunni scholars can be viewed, I want to suggest that cultural institutions, religious institutions, and practices cannot be studied in isolation from their specific political context. So that when you look at dissimulation, one of them, I would say that if there's anything that can be taken from some of the rather wordy things I've said today, is that dissimulation was not simply a method of overcoming persecution in areas where Shi'is were minorities, but it was a very powerful tool for the creation of more egalitarian possibilities, and that the secret knowledge itself carries considerable weight for the person with whom one has the secret withheld from. And it's interesting because the discussion about taqiyya has survived in the contemporary world to the extent that you can find an image like Taqiyya for Dummies on the internet. But also when Muslims, whether Sunni or Shi'i, are giving testimony. For instance, I saw an article online from a conservative political magazine that called Representative Keith Ellison's testimony before the congressional hearings on the radicalization of Muslims in the U.S. as a case of a Muslim congressman using taqiyya to pretend that he was American and that he actually cared about American security. So that the connection between the performance of taqiyya and suspicion, I think, survives in the popular imagination between Muslim and non-Muslim others, but also continues to be flung around as an allegation between Sunni and Shi'is as modes of interaction occur across both sides. And there I will conclude on that note.